Accession number 17629, David Ridley, reel 16.
Mr. Ridley, reel 16. What other memories of the Italian campaign have you, Mr. Ridley?
Well, one peculiar thing that happened with me, when I was wounded, I didn't go to hospital. I just stopped with the Coolish Army in this particular farmhouse. And our beds was just a blanket on the floor. And this Italian lady came asking about blanketto, which is blankets. And I thought she wanted to buy me blankets. I said, I'm very sorry. I said, I can't sell you these. I said, you know, that's all I've got. No, no. And she's pointing to the wall. And when he finally got through me, and she was wanting something behind this wall. So I moved my bed, and her husband came and dug the bricks out. And behind the wall was an alcove that had bricked up. And in there was all the wool blankets, you know, the winter wear, all the wool blankets. And that's the first time I realized what they'd been doing. And the second time was when we attacked this ridge after I'd been wounded, when we finally got into these houses, there was one house, it was knee-deep in ladies' powders and lipsticks and all that. They had been hidden in the walls, and one of our shells had gone through the wall and scattered all over the place. So that was the second time. And the third one, which was most amazing, well, you know, most grapevines are as flat as a billiard top. We had to go to Battalion HQ, this battalion. This was in the rest area just outside Fawley. We had to go to a Battalion HQ to have a demonstration by a flamethrower. The sort of issue was with flamethrowers, which was like a car wheel on your back, like a tube on the back. Manpack, I think they called it. And the place where they would demonstrate this, these Italians was taking this thing out of the ground, and when I went over, do you believe it or not, do you know what was buried in there? It was a petrol bowser, great big petrol tanker. And I'm not, you couldn't tell. They had these great big logs over the top and covered it with earth, and they were rolling these logs back, and it was in about a foot of water. And about 3 days after that, our carriers pulled it out for them, and a couple of days after that, I had it going. And that's what they buried. And this is what the Germans were doing. When they were retreating, they were taking everything they could, taking it away with them. So that was one or two little things that was interesting.
Just
there.
Before we move on to your next memory, flamethrowers, did you actually use them in action?
Yes, uh-huh. The time when I got my award was... this farmhouse was raised off the ground a bit, you know, just on an embankment. And in this embankment was the Germans dug in there. And this particular chap that had this flamethrower, he sprayed all that area. But that's the only time I've ever seen one used.
It must have been pretty dangerous for the chap that was carrying it.
Well, he pressed the trigger and the flames came out, you could see him a mile away. Was very nasty at the other end, like, because it was like a jelly that used to spray out. And if this jelly got on you and it reignited, you couldn't put it out. So I imagine anybody getting burned with that, they'd had it. There wasn't very much more that happened, apart from one thing. By then, the German was more or less, it had more or less disappeared. And in fact, I was appointed to do a brigade guard. And I always remember I had no blanco or anything, and we whitened all our equipment with toothpaste just to make it look smart. The other main thing that happened was about this sign that was sent to me. Now, I was sent by Major Gray one day. He says, I'm sending an ex-sergeant to your platoon. And he says, I want you to keep your eye on him. I says, well, you know, what's the reason? He says he was sentenced to death, his fellow. Now, later on, I didn't realize that various, like my wife's friend's sister, married this Wally Innes, who lived at Burley.
What was his name?
Wally Innes. He lived at Burley. He's been trying to clear his name for years. He's dead now, right? But he's been trying to clear his name for years. But what they call mutiny or disobeying orders doesn't work with the British Army.
This is the case where quite a number of the regiment have been transferred, in effect, to other units, other than the battalion.
Well, Wally came to my platoon. I never said, didn't even mention it to him. And he hadn't been there 5 minutes, and he was one of the boys. Always did what he was told. And in fact, he was... He became a member of the football team. Now, after the war, when I came home and realized, well, Wally, I would meet Wally. He was on the committee at the British Legion Club at Burley. Sometimes I would, you know, meet him there, and after getting a few jars, he would start talking about it. And this is his story. Him and quite a lot of chaps were in hospitals and various other places when the regiment moved back to England. And they were came back to England to prepare for D-Day. And they were promised when they were put on this ship that they were coming back to join the regiment. Unfortunately, Montgomery did one of his U-turns. I forget the name of the place now. But the hop round behind the line where the... where Casino was. That line particularly there. Montgomery did a flip round behind that line. And when they landed, there was no opposition. They went in about 15 mile, and instead of getting reinforcements in and there, and, you know, the war would have probably been over then, but they slipped up again. And then when the Germans found out where they were, they started to attack them. Now, this particular ship was passing through the Med coming home, and they started to shout for reinforcements. So whoever it was turned around and said, right, that ship into this place, and offloaded them. Now, it wasn't just Wally Innes. There was officers, sergeant majors, and all them above Wally Innes. Wally Innes was a sergeant. And they just sat down and said, no, we're not going to go up. We promised to go back to our regiment. And they just sat. So therefore, they put them in a little perimeter. And eventually, the officers went up the line. Eventually, the sergeant majors went up. And Wally Innes says, no, he says, it's bloody principal alone. He says, I'm not. He says, so there was him. There were two sergeants, actually, Wally and someone else. And he had about 20 men. And they were eventually kept in the prison camp. And he was eventually tried and sentenced to death. Now, he told me about this. He says, I was marching to this office. And his officer says, read that. And he says, all out, you have been sentenced to that. And he says, I couldn't read any more, Dave. He says, my mind just went blank. And he says, I give it back. The officer says, would you please read that? He says, what's the matter? Can't you bloody read? This was his attitude. And this was the attitude of all the officers. He says, when we move from A to B in various prison camps, he says, it wasn't on what we did, it was the letters that went beforehand. And he says, they were more or less discriminating against them, saying, you know, watch these fellas and all that. And he says, we hadn't been there 5 minutes And he says, the guard, they used to take the guards off, and he says, we're playing football with the guards. Anyway, he was eventually reprieved. And the next amusing thing happened, he says, I was sent by the army commander, mate. He said, I remember I was in Naples, and he said, I went up these massive, great big marble steps into this, you know, great big building. And I don't know who the army commander was at that particular time. Might have been Alexander, I don't know. But anyway, he says, he listened to his story. He says, oh, look, he says, this is man to man. He says, I just want you to talk, you know, at so and so. So sure enough, they just sat and had a long chin, man. And by this time, say, Wally just really couldn't care less. He was, you know, just angry. If they sent him back to the battalion, he said, he told every officer, he even told the army commander, he says, look, I am not refusing to fight. He says, you send me back my regiment, and he says, that's it. I'll be, you know, another soldier. But he says, you promised us that you would send us back, and you broke your promise. That doesn't work with me. So he told the army commander this. So the army commander says, well, you know, he says, I've been out here 2 years. You know. Well, he says, aye. And he says, I've been out here 5 years. And he says, I've got a better bloody job than what I've got. And these is his words. And the army commander says, out, and off he goes. So he goes back into prison. Anyway, after about 3 weeks, he was sent for again. And he went in and he says, saluted and whatnot. He says, is this man the man again, sir? He says, no, it isn't. He says, there's a letter. He says, I'm sending you to the 1st Battalion, Dunham Light Infantry. He says, bloody behave yourself. And that's how we kept the 1st Battalion. This, in my opinion, is a misunderstanding between officers and men. You give a dog a bad name and that's it. And they're not always bad.
Did he come to you whilst there were still actions going on, or was the fighting finished when he reached you?
Oh, near enough, anyway, near enough. Well, the army, the German army had disappeared. Our army had disappeared. I mean, the tanks and all that, and all mobile troops of war chasing the German right back into Germany. And we were left in the Po Valley. I don't think there's anything more that I can say.
In the years that you knew him after the war, was he still very bitter about the experience?
Well, I don't know whether he was very bitter, but he was always trying to clear his name. I think the News of the World took his story at one time. And he was always saying to me, well, he says, there's people like you that knows me, and you and my platoon son, he says, people like you could, you know, I said, oh, no. To me, an order given is an order obeyed, doesn't matter what it is, whether it's right or wrong. And I just couldn't, I wouldn't do it like that.
Yes, it was exceptional. He and the others had fought right through the desert campaign.
Oh, that's right.
Then this occurred.
It was a matter of principle, really. They were promised, if they'd sent them back to D-Day, that's what there would be no bother. But see, they were so short of troops, because they had surprised the Germans. There was nobody there, actually. They surprised the Germans that if, I presume it was Montgomery that did this, if he'd had a back enough force to put it, the war would have been over there, because he was right behind, I tell you, they went about 15 miles and never saw a German. But after that, I mean, the Germans threw everything at them.
What other memories have you got of Italy before we move on?
In that particular action, I didn't say that, but the Wally told me, this is where they started using these miniature tanks. It was just a crawling bomb, actually. A bomb with tracks on, and it was worked by it was operated by a wire, and you used to run them over your sit tanks and then fire, blow your helmet off.
This was the Germans using these.
That was a new German seated weapon, you know. Hitler was on, always on about his secret weapons. And after that, we used to do our duties, guard duties and things like that, but we used to have a raid all the time because we acquired horses from the German army, and we used to go out riding and dancing at night and parties.
How long did that take place? How long were you there? This was in this Forli region, wasn't it, where you were at rest, was it?
Oh, well, it must have lasted about a year after that. And we eventually moved right up on the Bulgarian border, on Yugoslav border. There we associated with the Yugoslav army. And they had women in their army. At least they looked like women. Damn, mate, they were built like store horses. Massive, yo.
Do you remember the name of the actual area you were in?
Gritsia.
And what happened there? What are your memories of that?
Well, we were just having a good time, really, you know, doing guard duties and various. And the Americans was also in there. One of their headquarters. We were there quite a long time. And
were there any problems at that point with the Yugoslavs between those that had helped the Germans and Tito? Did you have any problems?
No, no. We used to do a lot of this show the flag. We used to patrol the borders of Yugoslavia. Well, there wasn't any border, really, but we used to patrol through their villages, and they did exactly the same, just to say that we're British, you know. It was called showing the flag. That's how I met up with them. I once did a guard for them. Our CEO had invited some of their officers to a dinner. And I don't know, I was always choose for these blue ones. I don't know whether I was a smart soldier or what, but I was always seem to get the blue ones jobs. I had to do a corner guard. And, give them the old, as they come marching by, give them the old present and whatnot. But we used to send sections out on this show of the flag. They would get near enough a company, all and not in threes, you know, there were about six in a row, six rows come marching through the village where you used to, you know, the old bull, you used to turn the guard out and give them a present.
Was there any problem with refugees? There must have been a lot of people milling around.
No, I never saw many.
Not coming back from Germany as forced labour.
No, I never saw any.
What about looking for SS men or whatever, you know, in that region. Was that going on?
I didn't know. The only Germans I ever saw was when I was a convalescent in Sorrento. I was convalescent in Sorrento. And I heard these females saying, you know, bye-bye, and what is Abida saying? I said, oh, they're blooming Germans, them. That's about the only one. I did contact a lot of females who had lost a husband. They used to come and ask us, you know, have you seen this? Have you seen? Even the partisans, the Hugo partisans, used to take Italian male to be soldiers, you know, forcibly take them away. And the Germans used to do the same thing. No, I don't think the Germans took them away for to be soldiers, but took them away for, you know, slave labour and things like that. There's quite a lot of people in Gritsia that the husbands had disappeared. Whether they ever return or not, I don't know. I wouldn't know, like, probably if I ever go back.
Did you get on well with the Yugoslavs that you did come in contact with?
Ah, yes. Well, you had Gritsia's on the borders of Yugoslavia and Italy, see. So you had farmhouses on the Italian side who had Yugoslavs in, and vice versa. The only other thing that is interesting about that area, there was a big town on the Adriatic coast. Oh, forget the name of it. Trieste, a big town called Trieste. And as far as I know, the Italians fought for us in the Great War, and they were given Trieste for fighting with the British. Now, the Yugoslavs fought with the British in the last war, and they thought they were entitled to have Trieste back. So you were always having blooming battles in Trieste. Not shooting battles, but only demonstrations through the Italians and the Yugoslavs. But the most people that used to sort them out was the American police, military police. And I've seen a square in Trieste filled with thousands of Yugoslavs chanting, you know, and all this. And his Jeep would drive right into the centre with about five American coppers in, and they would get out, and all that carry great big buttons about a yard long. And he used to say, move. If you didn't. As I say, that we very, very rarely had anything to do with demonstrations. And this particular area in Trieste was always done by the Americans, and their police. They didn't take no for an answer. If you didn't move, you got walloped. And they were the ones that did create it. I remember old CEO Paddy May, he had one and gave her a lecture about rioting. Because in this area, it was quite a lot of trouble because the Yugoslavs were trying to gain land and the Italians weren't going to give it up. And he used to say the tactics of these demonstrations used to put the women in front, the women and the men behind. And they knew the British soldiers would attack the women. So I remember that somebody said to the CEO, well, what do we do about the women? He says, well, I suggest you carry some pins and stick pins. Stick pins in women. The women are worse than the men. The women will see you off. Will crack your head with a blown lump of wood.
But you never got called out to do
it. No, we were prepared, though. We weren't allowed to carry weapons. We carried the only thing that we carried was pig handles, you know. And this was the remark about the deal with women. The stick pins and, you know, boys, the stick a knife in and think no nothing of it. And I think in the old days, the old Indians, if they caught prisoners, the torture, the prisoners, it wasn't the men that did it, it was the women. Well, anyway, that's from there we moved to a spa place. I'm not quite sure the name. It was in the centre of northern Italy. There we stationed there quite a long time. This is the time when I was telling you about where King had vomited blood and died out of the Latimized section. But anyway, we went to this place and we stationed there for quite a while. And we used to do the old quarter guards. And I always remember I've got photographs of the 2 6-pound anti-tank guns put out on the entrance of this place to make it look nice. We used to do guard down there, just to impress the Italians. And at that particular time, our RSM broke his ankle and I had to take over his duties. And I was acting RSM for quite a long time. From there, I managed to get a month's leave at home. So I travelled to Milan and we got on a train in Milan and went into Switzerland and through France home.
Do you remember when this was?
Pardon?
Do you remember when this was, when you got your leave?
No, not really. I would have to look through my records, I don't know. Right? Anyway.
So that must have been quite an exciting time for you to be going home.
Oh, it was, right. And it was well over his eyes as well. Anyway. One thing I can vividly remember, we passed, at that particular time, was the longest rail tunnel in the world, from Italy into Switzerland. Now, we weren't allowed the train, when we got through into Switzerland, we weren't allowed to get off the train. But the Swiss people were coming with oranges and apples and throwing them in the windows. And I remember seeing these girls dressed with skis on their shoulders and lovely rosy cheeks and all that. That's about the only thing I can remember of that. We went back the same way to Milan. Well, when we got to Milan, we'd heard that the battalion moved, had gone to Greece. So there was a sergeant and myself that went on leave together. I think he came from Stockton, this fella. He used to be the signal sergeant in the battalion. Him and I came home and we went back together.
Can I just ask you one question, or one or two questions about your leave? You'd been awarded a very high medal, the Distinguished Conduct Medal. You must have been a bit of a hero when you came back. Were you received as such?
Well, I was, but people didn't, come and ask me. I was more or less pointed, You could see people, they were talking about you. It wasn't until I actually went for my medal. The local, the press in London published photographs and that in the local papers.
And did you go for your medal when you were on your leave?
No, after the war. No, I just had a good time. And if it hadn't have been for that leave, I would have been in the army until the end. Which is another little story later on. Anyway, I went back, and as I say, at the Royal Head in Milan, they said, well, the battalion's moved. They've gone to Greece. So we got on this train, and we travelled, nearly a day and a half, right to the foot of Italy, Taranto. And when we got off the train, reported there, and told them who we were, they said, well, our battalion's gone to Greece. He said, no, they haven't. He says, they're up the road. We're only about 100 yards up the road. So we walked up, reported, and we're back in the battalion again. Now, while I'd been on leave, nearly all my company, anyway, had partly been released. And the company I had, we're all young fellas. And bring this point out. The first morning I ever paraded them, I inspected them. And I was inspecting the uniforms and the personal appearance or so. And I was looking at some of the rifles that were a little red, rusty. Anyway, after I'd done that, I started to inspect the rifles. And this one bloke, he couldn't even get his bolt out of his rifle, it was rusted in. So they all got a right telling off in no certain form. And all the issues were, well, we've got no equipment. I says, well, where do you normally get equipment from for to clean your rifles? Oil, planet, pull throughs, I think. Well, the company stores. I says, well, you know where the company stores is. Why didn't you go and ask her? So they all got a right telling off at a parade. Well, not just one parade, two or three parades to make sure the rifles were clean. They were more or less recruits. And I was back again of the old end. I trained them, drill, drill, drill. And I finally won a drill competition with this company at the finish. They were canny lads.
Were these the beginning of the National Servicemen coming in?
Yeah, right. Yeah, they were all young chaps. And in those days, people were getting released so fast that you only had three stripes on, and then you had to take them off and put a crown on, or you had to put a crown above the stripes to be a colour sergeant. And then the next week, you had to check that off, you were being a sergeant. You weren't troubled very fast.
What rank did you hold at this time?
I was sergeant at the time. And when I got back, I was made sergeant major. And then I was sergeant major right up till I was about released. We finally left Toronto and went to Greece. And we landed at Salonika.